From the macabre minds of Laughing Devil Production comes another story from the Nightshade Diary. You know what that means. Check under the bed and make sure no one or nothing is there. Is the closet door securely shut? Then leave your disbelief behind, amp up your imagination, and hang on tight for another ride into terror and mystery. And like all good horror stories, just imagine it's a dark and stormy night. And remember, screaming like a little girl is permitted. The Eye and the Finger by Donald Wandre. He was neither contented nor unhappy as he plodded up the 5 flight of stairs towards his room. His eyes felt weary. They always ached a little at evening after he had finished his day's work, for the bright lights of the department store bothered him. Not the shrill voices of women which swept into his ears for 8 hours like a thin, far scream. Not the mask of calmness that rules compelled him to wear. Not the standing on his feet, the smirking, bowing, directing, explaining, and approving. He had long become used to these. They varied. Their relative values changed. But the glare of the lights was a tireless, implacable enemy. He reached the second floor. The half-gloom of the staircase soothed him. Tomorrow, he would draw his salary check. The $25 would guarantee his existence a week longer. If the fatal pink slip came with his salary, he could last about 3 weeks by scrimping and letting the rent slide. He was vaguely conscious of these possibilities, but they didn't prey on his mind. 5 years of steady employment had fitted him into routine. Passing the third floor, he smiled politely at a woman. He had seen her before and was often on the point of speaking, but didn't know her name. At the fourth floor, he hesitated. He had a notion that he had forgotten something. He checked off the evening newspaper under his arm, the toothpaste in his pocket, the laundry that would arrive later. Halted there under the bulb on the landing, he showed no distinguishing features. No one would notice him in a crowd. Away from the store, he was diffident, mild-mannered, and he himself found it hard to characterize his appearance whenever he faced a mirror. He climbed onto the fifth floor. His room had an old lock on the door, which he had never yet succeeded in opening on the first try. He worked the key back and forth until the lock turned. As soon as the door stood open, he felt for the wall switch, and when the light came on, he closed the door with a backward kick of his foot. An eye was lying on the top of his bureau. He sighed instantly, for the eye was staring at him. He grew ill at ease, for he had few friends and did not like practical jokes. Or perhaps one of the children in the building had thoughtlessly played a prank upon him. That must be the explanation. He felt relieved, though he couldn't imagine how the locked door had been overcome. He walked over to the bureau and picked up the eye. A strange, colossal silence all at once enveloped him, in which he distinctly heard the tiny paws of a mouse scampering through the walls. Then a great roaring swept up, so that his eardrums throbbed to the hammer of gigantic poundings. The eye was living, humid, and horrible to feel. He dropped it. The eye made a soft, dull plup as it hit the bureau. It rolled and came to a stop, staring unwinkingly at him. A moist film clung to his thumb and forefinger. He backed away from the bureau, his gaze glued to the eye. Surges of thunder and blankets of incredible silence alternately shook him and numbed him. The eye watched him retreat. He backed into a chair and jumped nervously from the contact. The room whirled. Among the shifting objects, a cup crossed his vision. He remembered a piece of cardboard in a box of stationery. He got the cup and the cardboard, but was loath to approach the eye. It continued to look at him with a singularly intense, compelling, and mournful fixity, as though it wished to convey a message. He turned the cup upside down and dropped it over the eye. The cardboard rustled as it slid across the cloth spread that covered the bureau and slid under the cup. Something rolled around inside the small area of the prison. He lifted the cup and cardboard, walked to the door, and went out down to the street. A terrifying motion, like the slow progress of a slug, took place between the pasteboard and the cup. The faint warmth that seeped through seemed searing flame upon his palm. He deposited the cup in a waste can and weighted it with a brick so that whatever was on the inside of it could not escape. He returned to the main entrance of the building where he lived. The threshold blocked him by an invisible barrier that he could not force himself to cross. Walking on, he felt better when the doorway receded behind him. Passersby did not register upon his consciousness. He had no memory of streets, nor of pavements flowing beneath his measured tread. It startled him to discover that he walked indeed with solemn paces, instead of strolling at random as he had planned. He was tramping through night, but the street lamps at space intervals broke the darkness with rings of light. They measured in time to the beating of his footsteps, in rhythm with the far roaring and alternate silences that divided his ears. If he had been walking in a funeral procession, he could not have chosen a more appropriate gait. He paid no attention to the lapse of hours, until he looked up and found himself again in front of the entrance. Aching weariness made him realize the miles he must have covered during his half-stupor. The shock, the grip of horrific nightmare, only now waned, and as it passed away, he began to wonder what had caused him so vivid an illusion of living through an experience that had no connection with any previous part of his life. He began climbing the stairs, the 5 flights. His hand, clutching the banister, helped him pull along. The wood felt clammy, as though sweating to damp air. The atmosphere must have been saturated, for beads of moisture collected upon his forehead. The heavy pounding of his heart commenced upon the 3rd floor. He went on, a sense of constriction and of doom accompanying him. Arrived at last in front of his door, he listened and heard the creaking sounds of the building. What else could he have heard? He wondered, breathing audibly. The key wouldn't work, until he remembered that he had forgotten to lock the door. He pushed it open slowly, and the light in the room gave him a moment's panic, until he remembered that he had forgotten to press the switch when he carried the eye out. He entered. Frozen into immediate paralysis, he jerked only when the door swung shut of its own accord upon its ill-balanced hinges. The click came to his ears like a detonation in the midst of a desert of solitudes. A hand hung in midair, a hand that pointed at the open window. Where it should have been attached to an arm, he clearly saw blood, veins, flesh, muscular tissue, and bone. But it did not bleed, and there was no body, and the nap of the rug underneath it remained erect. He stared at the hand with blind, unreasoning, raging horror. The hand curled, so that the forefinger pointed directly at him. It curled in no haste, but as inexorably as the tick of time. His first instinct to flee forever from the room he suppressed. He heard the rumble of wheels upon a street, and in the presence of that familiar reality, he could not yield to this visitation that had no right to afflict him, for if he rushed out not to return, he could never go through all years to come if faced the haunting of events that he could not explain. His breath came in deep gulps and trembling fits of exhalation as he advanced. The hand, hanging without support, pointed straight towards him. He drew nearer and nearer, but could detect no change in its position. The room fell away from his vision. Light and darkness departed, leaving him in a universe composed only of disembodied hand and himself. He seized the hand, intending to hurl it far out the open window. The fingers instantly curled around his own, not fiercely, but tugging him along, pulling him toward the window. For a step, he followed, hypnotized and unnerved. The hand felt neither living nor dead, neither hot nor cold. Its touch brought unrelieved terror, because it resembled nothing that he knew. It seemed most like the clasp of some fantastic alien, not of this or of any other imaginable world, but of a solidity beyond. It felt like a marginal thing, trapped midway between stone oblivion and tissue of life. He pulled, and the hand reluctantly, with heavy drag, yielded, drifting away from the window as upon the surface of an unseen ocean. The fingers retained their firm clasp, all save the forefinger, which opened like an unfolding worm. He fought the hand. He seized the forefinger with a tug that tore the other fingers loose. The forefinger began to curl inward upon his left palm. His right fist hit and hammered it. He freed himself wholly from the corrupt touch and backed away, a salt taste upon his lips. The hand relaxed. It drifted over to the spot at which he had first observed it. His own hand was shaking incessantly, and yet all the rest of him seemed ice. Not until the marginal thing had resumed its former position did he manage to overcome his paralysis. But the palsy of his hands continued. If the marginal thing had only attacked him, if it would try to overtake him, track him down, hound him deliberately, he could have coped with physical, tangible horror in action. The fiendish element was the thing's confidence. It urged, without threatening him, and waited because it had the whole of time till doomsday. A tail caught his glance. Not once letting the hand out of his sight, he took the tail from its rack by the washbowl. The forefinger curled up in a dreadfully wagging gesture as he drew near again. The tail trembled even before he flung it over the marginal thing. He grabbed the four ends, wondering if the prisoner had escaped. With the corners of the tail clutched, distinctly felt a weight, heard and saw a gruesome scrabbling within the bulge. His descent was nightmare. He twisted the ends of the tail and held the bag that imprisoned the creature under his arm. There it squirmed, nudging him with fingers that prodded inquisitively. Towards the ground floor, the forefinger began a diabolic tapping in measure with the beating of his heart, and when his heart skipped, the tap did not come. At the refused receptacle, he had a compulsion to lift the cup and find if the eye had escaped, but the fear of knowing proved greater than the fear of not knowing. He knotted the tail to a mass of iron. He walked away rapidly, then to escape the scuttling flurry that threshed the cloth. The one man who could help him was Dr. Ben, the psychiatrist who lived nearby. The psychiatrist did not like being called from bed. At first gruff, then skeptical, impatient, soothing, and interested in turn, he finally agreed to accompany the patient. "It will at least help to settle your nerves for the night, when I've proved that nothing unusual is present," said Dr. Ben reassuringly. "The hallucination may return, of course, but you'll be better prepared because you'll understand that it is a hallucination. I almost wish you were right, though. What an uproar it would create among my colleagues. But, of course, such things simply can't be, can they?" "No, they can't be, but they are. Why do they happen to me? Why not somebody else? Why not you?" Dr. Ben did not answer. The street, now dark and long deserted, echoed their tread as they entered the building. The echoes had a dismal, reverberating sound, as forlorn, as final as footsteps toward the grave. The psychiatrist breathed a trifle more heavily by the time he had reached the fifth floor. He was not used to such effort. He waited for the door to be opened. His companion, however, had difficulty with the key and the lock, partly because of the palsy, partly because he had again forgotten that the door was merely closed. When he finally opened it, the light in the room likewise made him rigid for a moment. The pattern of his life had been swept away. Twice he had forgotten to extinguish the lights and to lock the door. The eye, an eye, was lying on top of the bureau. He saw it instantly, for it was staring at him. He pointed at it, cried out, but not even a whisper issued from his lips. He tried once more to speak, but the breath rattled around his throat below the level of an audible murmur. Dr. Ben half turned his head, a strange expression on his face. He seemed to be looking at his patient, but his pupils remained fixed upon the eye. The psychiatrist strode forward positively and yet with a frown. He exclaimed, "I don't wonder you got a shock. That's the most convincingly real artificial eye that I've seen. Whoever made it is a remarkable craftsman." He picked the eye off the bureau. An expression of utter loathing altered his features until they were as dustily gray as those of a corpse. He felt the eye quiver. A sickness, a nausea, added itself to the gray. He opened his fingers mechanically. The eye fell with a dull plop. Its pupil returned its gaze upon the other man, ignoring Dr. Ben. The psychiatrist stood dazed, his glance crawling towards the eye and the back to the film of moisture on his thumb and forefinger. His breathing became more rapid. All at once he turned, began walking, hurrying, running for the door. A voice harried him. "Wait! Wait! What is it?" The psychiatrist paused briefly, his face twisted into detestable ferocity and hatred. "What is it? I don't know. I don't want to know." "My province is psychology and mental hygiene. This is wholly outside my field. I know nothing about it. I do not care to have anything more to do with it. When I leave, I shall forget that I listened to you. I shall forget that I came here. I shall forget that anything happened. I shall leave instructions with my secretary that under no circumstances will my appointment be given to you whatsoever at this time hereafter. I refuse to accept your patronage. My practice is and will be confined to mental cases, not physical impossibilities. I can't help you. There's nothing that anyone can do to help you. This is your own problem. Work it out any way you see fit. Good night and goodbye." The door slammed. Even through the walls he could hear Ben's receding tread hurrying further and further below. The sound, fading swiftly, died away among the remote world. When he turned around, he uttered a whistling sigh. The eye upon the bureau still watched him unwaveringly, and in midair hung the hand, forefinger pointed towards the open window. He took a step in the direction of the hand. It began to swing towards him leisurely. Its supreme indifference, the impersonal confidence of that horrible marginal thing, obsessed him even more than the eye, and the eye with its cold, implacable stare had already initiated him into the brotherhood of the blind. The curtains gently swayed as he walked towards them. He did not look behind at the hand or the eye. The drapes rippled from the eddy of his plunge through the open window.